Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Lowering Intraocular Pressure in Glaucoma, Medical Therapy versus Surgical Therapy, which is certified by Medscape CME and presented by L.J. Katz, M.D., Ronald L. Gross, M.D., and Brian A. Francis, M.D. Dr. Katz is a professor of ophthalmology, Jefferson Medical College, Thomas Jefferson University. Director, Glaucoma Service, Wills Eye Institute, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Katz has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Glaukos Corporation. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Alcon Laboratories, Allergan, Pfizer, Heidelberg Engineering, and Luminous. He received grants for clinical research from Alcon Laboratories, Allergan, Pfizer, and Luminous. Dr. Katz does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Katz does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gross is a professor of ophthalmology and the Clinton R. McMichael Chair in Ophthalmology, Cullen Eye Institute, Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, Texas. Dr. Gross has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Alcon Laboratories and Allergan. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Alcon Laboratories and Allergan. He received grants for clinical research from Alcon Laboratories and Allergan. Dr. Gross does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gross does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Francis is an Associate Professor of Ophthalmology, Riffenberg Professor of Glaucoma, Doheny Eye Institute, Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California, Faculty, Ophthalmology, USC University Hospital, Los Angeles, California. Dr. Francis has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Bioformatics and Neomedics. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Luminous and Pfizer. Dr. Francis does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Francis does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to evaluate traditional first-line options and explore newer emerging options for lowering intraocular pressure in patients with glaucoma. This activity is supported by Alcon. To participate in the CME activity, please go to cme.medscape.com/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, welcome to CME CE Spotlight panel discussion entitled Lowering Intraocular Pressure in Glaucoma, Medical Therapy versus Surgical Therapy. My name is Dr. L.J. Katz. I am Professor of Ophthalmology at Jefferson Medical College, Thomas Jefferson University, and the Director of the Glaucoma Service at Wills Eye Institute in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I am pleased to be joined today by my colleagues, Dr. Ronald L. Gross, Professor of Ophthalmology, and Clifton R. McMichael, Chair in Ophthalmology at the Cullen Eye Institute, Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Brian Francis, Associate Professor of Ophthalmology and Riffenberg Professor of Glaucoma at the Doheny Eye Institute, Keck School of Medicine at University of Southern California in Los Angeles. The goal of today's program is to evaluate traditional first-line options and explore newer emerging options for lowering intraocular pressure in patients with glaucoma. The discussion will review the potential changes in the treatment paradigm for open-angle glaucoma. Glaucoma remains a serious problem in our country and in the world. There are 200,000 patients that are blind from glaucoma in the United States out of perhaps 4 million of those with glaucoma. In the world, 6 million are blind out of 67 million. It's the number two cause of irreversible blindness in the United States. It's number one worldwide and number one in African Americans and Latinos in the United States, costing society an estimated of $2 billion per year or more in the United States. We have a number of prospective randomized clinical trials, including the ocular hypertension treatment study, the early manifest glaucoma treatment study, the normal tension glaucoma study, the collaborative initial glaucoma treatment study, and the advanced glaucoma intervention study, all of which shown very conclusively that lowering intraocular pressure is very effective in preventing disease progression. However, the blindness that we see today from glaucoma can be attributed to a number of factors. These include society issues with access to health care, patient issues with non-adherence or compliance to therapy, and physician issues with inadequate diagnosis and therapy. Adherence is still a huge problem with any chronic disease such as glaucoma, and our best estimate is that perhaps 50 to 75% of our patients are reasonably compliant with chronic long-term therapy for glaucoma. Let's start with Dr. Gross today. When do you start with medical therapy in the treatment of open-angle glaucoma?
Well, Jay, I think once you've decided that glaucoma is present, that there is damage, recognizing that that may be structural to the optic nerve or functional based on visual fields, then treatment to lower intraocular pressure based on all the studies that you referred to earlier tells us that we need to intervene. And at that point, medical therapy becomes a very reasonable option in the therapy of an individual patient.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the results that we've seen with ocular hypertension treatment study as well as the collaborative initial glaucoma treatment study?
Well, I think in the ocular hypertension treatment study, it showed very nicely that treatment does decrease the risk of developing glaucoma. In those patients who were untreated over a five-year period, almost 10% of those went on to develop glaucomatous damage, whereas that was reduced by at least 50% with effective treatment, the goal being a 20% drop. In the initial glaucoma treatment study, comparing initial medicine versus surgery in the treatment of glaucoma, again, both were very effective in lowering intraocular pressure, and as a result, both were shown to be equally effective in minimizing the risk of progressive visual field loss.
What's your typical medical treatment regimen currently?
We have very many different options when treating patients with medical therapy. Though realistically, in the vast majority of cases, the prostaglandin analogs are our first-line therapy. They are more efficacious than any other single class. They're very systemically safe. They do have some local side effects that we have to be able to take care of and recognize. But overall, given their safety and efficacy profile, they're typically our first-line therapy.
What do you consider maximum medical therapy currently in a typical patient?
It's a difficult question. It's different for every patient. For some patients who are completely intolerant of medicines, it may be that they can't take any medicines at all. Conversely, others may do whatever it takes to avoid surgical intervention and may be on multiple medicines. In general, two bottles involving three classes of medication tends to be maximum tolerated medical therapy for most patients. It's important to show that all are effective and all are well tolerated.
Well, Ron, you've been in practice for a long time. Has your maximum regimen really changed over the past 20-some years that you've been around?
I have been around for a while. Thank you for pointing that out. But I think it has. I think we're more comfortable with both laser and surgical filtration surgery by several different means. As a result, we've also recognized that adding on the third and fourth different medication are probably not as effective as we would like them to be. So in general, I'm typically not going as far with medical therapy, that is to all the available medical classes before proceeding with surgical intervention.
What are the challenges with medical therapy that have kind of streamlined your approach? And any practical guidelines on how you treat medically to kind of maximize the chance of success?
As you referred to earlier, Adherence is very important. A medication does no good if the patient will not take it. So we have to give them a regimen that they can actually use. And that may be different for different patients based on the severity of their disease and their own individual desires. But it is important to make sure that patients are aware of how to put a drop in, what our expectations are, that is, as to frequency, how to do it, and give them a number that they're able to do. Good data shows that patients are willing to do things once a day or twice a day. It is much more difficult if you're asking patients to use a medication more than twice daily. Again, as you use more medications, different bottles, the regimen becomes more complex, and again, it's more difficult for them to be able to successfully manage that regimen.
Ron, I think it's also important to point out that these patients are not just on glaucoma therapy. So they may have other chronic diseases because they're in the elderly age class. And so they may be taking medications for hypertension, diabetes, heart failure, et cetera. And so you have someone that's on four or five systemic medications, you're adding 2, 3, 4 topical glaucoma medications, then you're talking about just really increasing the complexity of their total treatment regimen.
Absolutely true.
What about the cost issues? Does that play into effect as well?
Well, I think, yeah, cost issues for, you can separate cost issues both into societal cost and individual cost to the patient themselves. Certainly, if a patient's on, you know, multiple medications for multiple chronic diseases, their cost is going to be prohibitive, and they'll have to decide between their diabetes medication and their glaucoma medication, and that's not a position we want to put our patients in. And also, you alluded to in the introduction, the cost $2 billion in the United States alone. And the majority, great majority of the costs across the board for glaucoma treatment are medical therapy.
There's been no new drug class in the past 15 years introduced in glaucoma. Any ideas, well, you know, why that there's been such a drought?
I don't know that I could definitively answer the question, but I think we've got a pretty high barrier to try to overcome. You've got a prostaglandin analog that gives a 30 or 35% reduction in intraocular pressure with essentially no systemic side effects. So if you're going to come out with a new class, you're going to have to somehow surpass that either in efficacy or in safety. And at this point, the hurdle's been too great. They haven't been able to find a new molecule that's able to successfully do that.
What about adjunctive therapy, too? So you're saying prostaglandin is first line. What is typically your second line agent and why?
I think that varies by patient. I think the data that we have available to us to make those decisions are not nearly as good as the data that we have for first line therapy. In general, if you're on a prostaglandin as first-line therapy, I typically go to either a topical carbonic anhydrase inhibitor second-line or an alpha agonist. Beta blockers, though effective in some patients, given the experience that we've seen with fixed combinations of beta blockers and prostaglandin analogs, probably are not the best second-line agent, though they are still the most commonly one used and are very appealing because of their potential for once-a-day therapy. Among the topical carbonic anhydrase inhibitors and the alpha agonists, I think they each have their own advantages and disadvantages. I think the advantage of the topical carbonic anhydrase inhibitor is that it has less in the way of peak trough concerns compared to the alpha agonist, but both can be effective when added to a prostaglandin analog.
Where do you think the new areas of research are going with medical therapy? We had talked briefly about fixed combinations, and there's an interest in fixed combinations because of better adherence for the patient, fewer bottles, and that makes sense. But besides the fixed combinations that you've mentioned thus far, any other new areas of research that you think medical therapy is heading towards?
I think the next big step in medical therapy is going to be new methodology of extended drug delivery. We talked earlier about the difficulty with adherence of patients putting multiple drops in multiple times a day. And again, we've got to remember that this may be for the rest of their life. So the idea of being able to intervene, whether with an intraocular injection, a periocular injection, or some other type of delivery device that allows us to effectively medically treat the patient and take that daily installation of drops out of the patient's hands. We have excellent medications. We now have to give them the tools that whereby they can become adherent without having to use those drops on a daily basis.
Well, before we have Brian talk about lasers and surgery, I'm going to ask you, Ron, is there any instance where you would give the patient the opportunity to have laser or incisional surgery as the first step in treating their glaucoma?
Absolutely. Whenever I make the diagnosis and determine that therapy is appropriate, I always have the discussion with the patient that we can lower your intraocular pressure. That's what we've got to do. How effectively we do that will determine how well we can minimize your risk of progressing. We can do that with drops. We can do that with laser to the natural drain of the eye. We can do that with cutting surgery. We have excellent studies that support all three as reasonable options. They all have their advantages and disadvantages. Most patients pick medical therapy as their initial therapy, but there are certainly instances where the others may be more appropriate.
So if I understand correctly, I think you've mentioned that the patient, at least in our country, the patients are given the opportunity to decide their own fate. And are you saying that most patients prefer to start with medical therapy as opposed to intervention, like laser or surgery?
In my practice, obviously my biases and all of our biases probably fit into the way our patients make decisions. But particularly if it's the first time you've met the patient or you don't have a long established relationship, most patients prefer to start with medical therapy, evaluate how well they do on it, both from an efficacy and a tolerability and a safety standpoint, and then make a decision. Early on, if that's not effective or not well tolerated by the patient, then proceeding rapidly to surgical intervention still remains a viable option.
Well, that's certainly the classic teaching that we've been a product of in our training and the way we've trained our residents and fellows over the years. But I'll be interested in hearing Brian talk about his viewpoints. I think there are some patients that clearly would opt for laser or perhaps even incisional surgery in the right circumstances. And maybe we should have Brian give us his thoughts as to where, let's start with laser trabeculoplasty as the initial treatment. Well, where do you think that fits right now in your practice?
In my practice, I feel that any patient with an open angle who you would consider medical therapy is a candidate for laser trabeculoplasty. I think in my practice, I view initial medical therapy and initial laser therapy as pretty much equal. I think they're equal in efficacy. I think the side effects are similar and low in both instances. I think the main difference is in adherence. I think that I tell my patients that the compliance with laser treatment is 100%. Because it may not be 100% effective, but you know you've given it, and it's either going to work or it's not going to work. Whereas if you prescribe a medication, you don't really know if that medication works or not because of the whole problem with adherence and compliance. And so going down that slippery slope of one medication, two medications, three medications, four medications, I think that's a difficult thing when you don't even know if they're working at each step of the way. So in my practice, I will present to the patient both options, even as initial therapy.
There are studies out there, even going back to the glaucoma laser trial back in the 90s, showing that argon laser trabeculoplasty as initial therapy was fairly effective. And subsequently, there have been studies with selective laser trabeculoplasty showing that it's effective. Why do you think that really hasn't been implemented in clinical practice to date? What are the the restrictions that you see why it hasn't been more broadly embraced as a first-line option?
Well, you bring up a good point with the glaucoma laser trial with argon laser trabeculoplasty. It actually showed that ALT was quite effective and actually equally effective as medical therapy in treating glaucoma. I think the problems were that eventually the effect wore off, and so the majority of patients that had laser initially eventually ended up on medications. I think that's one drawback. So that gets us to the point of long-term treatment with laser and possibly repeatability. And I think with the newer laser modalities such as selective laser trabeculoplasty and the ability to treat 360 degrees and treat again if the effect wears off over several years has really shifted my practice more towards laser away from medications.
Before we get into the incisional surgeries, every patient's different, obviously, but what's the typical profile of a patient that would opt, or different class of patients that would opt for laser trabeculoplasty as the initial treatment when you give them the choice? So can you kind of categorize patients a little bit there?
Well, yeah, we don't want to pigeonhole patients, but in general, I think patients that are younger are more accepting of new technology. And in my opinion, patients that are older are a little more apprehensive about laser treatment. And one of the problems is the job of education that we do. When someone hears laser, they kind of lump that in with other lasers, lasers for AMD, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, you know, and most of those patients end up losing some vision as a result of that disease. So these patients you know, have that idea where laser is going to be harmful to them, where in fact, you know, I think the studies that, you've said, and one that you were the PI on was the SLT versus medication therapy, you know, that show that they're pretty equivalent.
But one thing I would add, I agree with what you said about lasers, but you also have to put in their refractive laser, where they have this idea that it's curative that they never need, you know, I'm one and done and I'm fine. Whether they choose medications first or laser first, which I agree both are reasonable options, the most important thing is that they find a doctor, that they can be consistent with their follow-up, because with either one, you don't know for sure that the therapy is going to be adequate, and with the laser trabeculoplasty particularly, it's going to wear off, and it's important that they continue their follow-up so you know when that occurs.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, no therapy is forever, and that includes incisional surgery as well. And so, yeah, you're right. We have to educate the patients. You know, this is a long-term disease. No matter how you're treated, your treatment may evolve, you know, over the years, and, you know, the follow-up is essential.
Just to maybe elaborate a little bit further, I think that the patients I've seen that are opting for laser first are often patients that are executive decision makers. They tend to be the younger people, like you said, but professionals who know how to make decisions based on evidence that you presented to them in the discussion. And also people that really don't have the ability to use medications for whatever reason. They can't put drops in. They have bad rheumatoid arthritis. They don't have really any money to buy medications. Those often are the people that I've seen that go ahead and opt for laser first. Why don't we talk a little bit about incisional approaches for glaucoma? That's become very complex now. Can you kind of give us, Brian, your kind of laundry list of surgical options for patients?
Sure, Jay. You know, I basically divide surgical therapy into, you know, aqueous inflow and aqueous outflow. Aqueous inflow would be, you know, endoscopic cyclophotocoagulation or transscleral cyclophotocoagulation. Outflow procedures can be further subdivided into external filtering surgery, such as your trabeculectomy, tube shunt, and now Express, and then your internal filtering surgeries, where you don't, where you're trying to enhance the natural drainage system, canaloplasty, iStent, trabectome, you know, that category. So there, you know, as you said, there is a wide variety of procedures that are available to us now. And I think if we use them in the right patients, you know, a lot of them are certainly appropriate as initial therapy.
Before we start talking about some of the commonly used ones, I want you to give me an idea of why you think non-penetrating surgeries like deep sclerectomy, viscocanaloplasty really never took off very much in the United States as opposed to other places in the world. And people that did use it really don't use it much, as much anymore. And on the other extreme, tube shunts have been kind of vaulted maybe into challenging trabeculectomy as the initial surgical procedure for glaucoma. And maybe comment on the tube versus trabeculectomy study. Has that really influenced what you do in clinical practice? And maybe Ron can speak up about that as well.
Well, I think, you know, the first point that you made about non-penetrating surgeries, I think a couple of reasons why they were not widely adopted in the United States. I think the big one is the learning curve. You're talking about a procedure where it's an external dissection and you're trying to unroof Schlemm's canal. And it's a very delicate surgery and difficult to do. It's still around, and I think it's evolving into some of these newer procedures like canaloplasty. Canaloplasty is basically a viscocanaloplasty, but with the addition of this suture cannulation of Schlemm's canal and tightening of the suture. So I think it's still there. It's just evolving into its next iteration. As far as trabeculectomy, I think is still the gold standard in terms of you know, widespread use. Efficacy is certainly excellent. I think all these other procedures have been developed trying to reduce the complications and risks seen with trabeculectomy. The TVT or tube versus trabeculectomy study. Has, I think, changed many people's paradigms towards doing tubes earlier. The study showed that there were less complications with tubes versus trabeculectomies in patients that had prior surgery, but the pressure, intraocular pressure results were similar between the two groups, albeit more medication use initially in the tube groups, but then evening out a couple of years out. In my practice, I did a lot of tubes before the TVT study, so I haven't really changed, you know, how I practice. But I think rather than doing a second trabeculectomy, a tube shunt is indicated, or as an initial procedure in someone that I think is at high risk for trabeculectomy failure or trabeculectomy complications. So let's say they have uveitic glaucoma, neovascular glaucoma, I would opt for tube shunt first. Also, if they've had problems with hypotony maculopathy or choroidal hemorrhage from trabeculectomy in the other eye, I would go towards a tube and maybe a stage tube procedure rather than trabeculectomy to avoid those risks.
A couple of points about the lack of use of the non-penetrating surgeries. I think the other problem is it was during the learning curve and even beyond, the unpredictability of the final outcome. And if it doesn't work, you've used up a large bit of real estate that's really not available for trabeculectomy should it be necessary. And I agree with the TVT. It hasn't changed much what I do. I think of a little concern was the complication rate in the trabeculectomy group was much higher than one would have expected, maybe related to their aggressive use of antimetabolites. Mm-hmm. But I agree, with or without the TVT, I think earlier use in appropriate cases of tubes is much more common now than it was many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe the antimetabolite was 0.4 milligrams of mitomycin for four minutes, which is typically more than I use in the average patient. So.
Also, I think just a quick word that the complications that were totaled up, if you have a transient hyphema, is that the same type of complication as having persistent double vision? Mm-hmm. One could argue that it's not the same level of concern. So even though they're totaled up maybe a little bit more in the way of complications with a trabeculectomy, some would argue that transient small complications aren't really much of a concern. Mm-hmm. You mentioned outflow procedures, inflow procedures, endoscopic cycle photocoagulation, ECP. Mm-hmm. Is that part of your practice, and where do you use it?
ECP and the inflow procedures in general are unique in that they can be used pretty much anywhere in the glaucoma treatment spectrum. So you can use it as an initial treatment. You can use it as a glaucoma treatment in someone who's having cataract surgery as an add-on procedure or adjunctive procedure. You can use it in failed trabeculectomy patients. You can use it in failed tube patients. And you can use it in the ultra-refractory patients that have had multiple tube shunts. So I think the versatility is good, and it's the only procedure that I use that will affect inflow. The other thing with that is it can be combined with an outflow procedure to enhance pressure lowering. So you can combine it with trabectome or canaloplasty or some of these other procedures to try to get lower pressures than you would with just the one procedure by itself.
Of the ways of doing cycloablative procedure, I think it's the most elegant. Again, as long as you have reasonable expectations, for the most part, I think it's used combined with cataract surgery, which makes sense. The idea being that you can get the patient off an additional medicine or two. It's not going to take the patient who's completely uncontrolled with pressures in the 30s. That's probably not a place that you want to do ECP. But in that patient who's relatively well controlled, where you'd like to decrease their medication load, or who's close to being controlled and you think you can get there with ECP without the need for additional filtration, it's a perfectly reasonable alternative with proper expectations.
I wanted to just backtrack one point with the TVT study. I think one thing that people don't think about maybe when they do tubes first is you may have painted yourself into a corner. What do you do after you've done a tube? Mm-hmm. The pressure is going up. You put them back on medications. Now, what do you do? Whereas if you've done a trabeculectomy and it works for a few years, then fails, you can proceed to a tube shunt. So I think that's
right.
When you're planning glaucoma surgeries and treatments, I think you need to plan a step ahead. You have to, and as you were saying, using up conjunctiva and real estate, is harmful in the end if you need to proceed to external filtering surgery.
That's a great point. We're pessimists by nature in glaucoma because it's always an uphill battle, and you have eliminated one step, just like you pointed out, by going straight to a tube in those patients. Could you address the fact that when you look at the Moorfields eye study, you look at the collaborative initial glaucoma treatment study, these are very nicely designed studies comparing trabeculectomy as the initial treatment for open-end glaucoma and compared it with medical therapy. The results are simply outstanding in both trials in looking at the trabeculectomy results. No issues of compliance. These people are controlled with incisional surgery. Why hasn't that impacted on what we do in clinical practice?
The main reason, I think, is because of the complications of trabeculectomy. I mean, if you do a study and you look at 1,000 patients and you look at the overall success rate, it's excellent, as you said. But all it takes is that one patient with endophthalmitis that loses vision, or the one patient with a hemorrhagic choroidal, detachment, and that's why people are reluctant to do trabeculectomy. I think, however, there's the surgical technique for trabeculectomy has evolved over time. I think it is safer now. It's more titratable. With the more widespread application of anti-metabolites, but lower doses, we're getting more diffuse filtering blebs. The surgical approach with using the conjunctival flap, with a fornix-based flap instead of a limbus-based flap, I think has given us better-looking blebs and better-functioning blebs without some of the risk.
Jay, like you, I participated in the initial glaucoma treatment study, and I can tell you that filtering somebody as their initial therapy for glaucoma is quite different than filtering the patient who's been under therapy with medications and or laser for many, many years. Their expectations are different. For the most part, they're asymptomatic when they start. And with medical therapy, with laser, they're still relatively asymptomatic. But with a trabeculectomy, they're not. Even with the gorgeous blebs that you sometimes can often end up with after trabeculectomy, in the patient who had no symptoms whatsoever before you operated on them, even the slightest change they perceive, and at times I have one patient who comes to mind who just loves to come visit me every 6 months to tell me how I've ruined her life. And it's a beautiful bleb with her pressure that's great. But in her mind, she was completely asymptomatic before it started, and now here's where she is. The other side of that is, in the initial glaucoma treatment study, as well as all others, incidents of cataracts and other things are going to be more frequent if you have initial filtration surgery compared to not. So there are things down the road unrelated to the surgery itself that may occur as well.
Well, Ron, how would you feel if we were doing CIGETs, but you could choose from any of the available procedures now instead of trabeculectomy, if you could choose, say, an iStent or trabectome or canaloplasty?
At this point, I don't think I'm aware of enough data of those to really understand exactly what the long-term expectations. Here you're talking about a 5-year study minimum, and I don't know that we have enough information to be able to really intelligently make that decision.
Well, I think you really hit on some very important points. I think that when you're looking at the outcomes that are looked at in these trials, what's the pressure, what's the visual field, what's the vision on the eye chart? I mean, in CIGETs and the Moorfields Eye Study and others, it may come across looking fantastic, but unfortunately it doesn't take into account sometimes the patient that does have that symptomatic bleb, or their vision's a little bit fuzzy, or they get one drop on the visual acuity line after incisional surgery. And you're right, those people aren't happy. And that's what you remember. It's not necessarily even the disaster cases. And interestingly enough, I think, for example, in CIGETs, there were virtually no disaster cases and all the incisional surgeries done as part of CIGETs. So the question is, can we improve even further? I think we have improved upon trabeculectomy compared to the way it was originally developed some 30 years ago. In fact, it's not even a trabeculectomy truly, because we don't take trabeculum out in 90% plus of the cases. But a lot of the problems that relate late after surgery, whether it's a bleb leak or a hypotony or blebitis or endophthalmitis, the things that we worry about even years after the operation, can we somehow change the morphology of the bleb? Or can we have a procedure that takes away the filtration bleb? So I'd like both of you to talk about whether you think that the express shunt, for example, as part of a trabeculectomy or a guarded filtering procedure, does that change the character of the filtration bleb? Does it make it a safer operation? What are your thoughts on that?
You made a very important point. With the express shunt, it's still a trabeculectomy. Basically, you're using the express instead of the punch or the knives and scissors that you use to take out the block, and a PI if you do a PI, particularly in phakic patients. At this point, I think for the person who that is a very uncomfortable portion of the procedure, I think it makes it much more predictable and much less stressful for the surgeon compared to the alternative in a trabeculectomy. data suggests that it may provide some resistance to outflow, though certainly when it was put in without a scleral flap, the hypotony was still a profound problem. So it's not completely protective by any means of that. But I think the important point is that this is still a trabeculectomy, and all that the of the parameters that you have to deal with, suture tightness, suture lysis, conjunctival closure, and the like, still remain and still are an important part of being able to be successful. It does make it a little more standardized, and it does make it a little more comfortable. That is, when you put it in, the chamber doesn't shallow, as may occur if you do a standard trabeculectomy.
Well, I agree. I think you have probably lower short-term complications in terms of hypotony and shallow anterior chambers. But then you have to there's a trade-off, and you may have more long-term complications, such as related to the device itself being in the eye. I think it's only really appropriate in open angle. If someone has, you know, even a 2+ or narrower angle, I think, you know, you might be running into problems with putting the express shunt in there in terms of corneal opacity or corneal failure or iris or lens trauma. But, you know, I agree with Ron. I think it really is a version of trabeculectomy, whether it's a better version or the same. I think that's up for debate.
And it's very important at this point. We need data. I mean, as you can see, we don't have long-term data to really be able to tell us, is it really safer? Are the outcomes really different with an express versus not?
Can you, both of you, talk a little bit about the non-bleb procedures out there? There are several of them, whether it's trabectome, canaloplasty, iStent. There are some tubes that are being placed in the suprachoroidal space. Do you think that's going to be an exciting new frontier for us, where you can do incisional surgery for glaucoma and get pressure reduction without having a filtration bleb?
I think it's very exciting. I think the idea, we all know that blebs have intrinsic potential to cause bad things to occur to the patient. And if we could avoid them, we all would agree that that would be a nice thing. Again, the problem with the newer interventions is that we don't have long-term data, and we don't have a good idea of what we can tell our patients is the expected long-term success. For the most part, I think there are safety advantages compared to a trabeculectomy. The real question is, what's the trade-off as far as efficacy and efficacy long-term for that added amount of safety?
I agree with you both that it is exciting to have these newer procedures out, the blebless or internal filtering surgeries. And they do certainly have, in my opinion, less complications than trabeculectomy, but the trade-off is not as much IOP lowering. But then you may, you know, as the paradigm shifts, you should use these procedures earlier on. So in someone who you may use 2 to 3 medical medications, maybe that should be someone that has one of these newer procedures to get their pressure down, you know, in initial glaucoma stages. Especially if someone has a cataract, a visually significant cataract, and they're already going to surgery.
But wouldn't you say that it's important that we distinguish cataract surgery alone has the potential to lower pressure, so it's mm-hmm. important that we understand mm-hmm. what's attributable to that as well as what's
right.
attributable to the
right. Certainly the combined procedures have been kind of muddied because of the data that cataract surgery itself can lower intraocular pressure. But I agree, we don't know, you know, what is the long-term efficacy of cataract extraction on intraocular pressure, and we don't know is the long-term efficacy of the combined procedures, you know, greater than that. So that'll all come out in the next 5 years, I think.
Can you give some pros and cons of specifically the procedures like canaloplasty, let's say, and trabectome, which are already being used in the real world currently? What are the pluses and minuses of both of those procedures?
The procedures are quite different, even though they are trying to get at the same area at the canal. Trabectome is done through a gonioscopic surgical approach, through usually a temporal clear corneal incision. So I think it's easier to do, I think. The dissection is minimal because you just make a clear corneal incision. As long as you have a good view of the open angle, it's a pretty straightforward procedure. And it is truly blebless, and you don't sacrifice any conjunctiva. The canaloplasty, on the other hand, you're getting at the canal from an external dissection, so you have to unroof the canal through a scleral flap, superficial and deep scleral flap. I think the advantage of canaloplasty may be in its versatility. You know, some doctors are using it as a quasi-filtering surgery, so they won't suture down the flap, or they may do a YAG goniopuncture early on if it looks like the pressure is not, you know, low enough. So you have a little bit more versatility in converting it more to a guarded filtering procedure, and so you may get, on average, lower intraocular pressures with that as a procedure.
Can you give a rough time estimate as to you know, typical time it takes you to do a trabectome as opposed to doing a canaloplasty?
So I have a lot more experience with trabectome than canaloplasty, but I do both. It takes about, you know, about 15, 20 minutes to do a trabectome, and it takes a good probably 45 minutes, you know, similar to trabeculectomy, actually a little bit longer than trabeculectomy for a canaloplasty.
I think that just to emphasize that the gonioscopic approach, which is very commonly used in your hands and you're very familiar with in the operating room, most non-glaucoma specialists are not really familiar with intraoperative gonioscopic surgery. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there are some of these other procedures that are designed to put in stents, whether it's into the trabecular meshwork or the supraciliary space. Any comments about those newer approaches? Do you think that it'll be, does it make more sense than just doing a trabectome?
I think iStent and trabectome are very similar in terms of, you know, what you're doing. I mean, the surgical approach is the same through a temporal incision, through a gonioscopic view. In both of those procedures, you're basically removing or trying to bypass trabecular meshwork. So I think, you know, I have not done iStent, but I assume that the results would be fairly similar, you know, to the trabectome. But it may depend on how much of the angle you're treating with each procedure as well. So you may have to do multiple stents with the iStent. But I think they'll be very similar in the end. The suprachoroidal shunt, I really don't have any experience with that, but from looking at the video, the surgical videos, I mean, the procedure looks like it's a, you know, you're still coming from an external approach. You make a conjunctival dissection, and you're having to place, and you're talking about surgery for non-glaucoma surgeons, you have to place this device in the anterior chamber and in the you know, suprachoroidal space, which is a little bit, you know, you have to cut down full thickness all the way through sclera down to the ciliary body, which for surgeons that are not familiar with that type of procedure may be a little daunting. So
right, that's a Solex shunt with that approach.
Yeah. Gold shunt.
Theoretically, it sounds great because the idea of being able to get to actually where there's a negative pressure in the supraciliary space, it really is intriguing. All the trabecular bypass shunts, as has been shown, there is resistance in the collector channels and in the episcleral venous pressure, so you never can probably get consistently to episcleral venous pressure just by bypassing the trabecular meshwork. But again, I think the exciting thing is that we're starting to talk about things. We're recognizing that what we currently have is not adequate, and hopefully this will allow us to evolve into a really effective, safer procedure to lower pressure effectively.
Well, in closing, I wanted to get both of you to look into the future and tell me if you think that there's going to be any major changes in the treatment paradigm, whether it's medical or surgical. And specifically, can you see any of the incisional or laser procedures being used even more frequently as a first-line option for open-end glaucoma?
Just to start with medical, I think increasingly as we go on, generics are going to play a bigger role in what happens to our patients' therapy. There are certainly cost advantages, but it does complicate our lives and may make what's already a complicated medical regimen even more complicated because of the numerous different generics that will be available for medications, so that may make it more likely that we would typically try to go to a surgical intervention. Again, if we can come up with something that's predictable, that's technically possible, that's more effective, that's safer, there's no question that would be much more readily accepted by both ourselves and our patients, but it's really going to be the data and the procedures that are going to tell us whether that's appropriate or not.
Well, I think, you know, medical therapy, it's just a matter of time before we come out with a new class of drugs. As you said, it's been, you know, 15 years or more. So I think we're looking forward to that on the horizon. And as Ron pointed out earlier, I think drug delivery is going to be huge in terms of medical therapy. basically taking compliance out of the patient's hands, and still using medical therapy. So whether that's, implants inside the eye or, externally applied implants, what have you, I think that's going to be huge in the next 5 years. I think there is a move towards earlier surgical and especially laser intervention. But obviously medications will always have a place because no surgery or laser is 100% effective. And so you may have a combination of surgery plus medications, in many patients.
Of course, one step beyond is that there are going to be some devices that we're going to use for surgical lowering of intraocular pressure that may even have drug delivery on top of it. So there may be a marriage in the future between both of them. I'd like to thank both of you for giving your kind of honest reflections on where we're heading with medical and surgical therapy for glaucoma. The discussion has pointed out the complexities of decision-making for the treatment of open-angle glaucoma. Factors such as the severity of the glaucoma, the general health and age of a patient will help direct the sequence of therapy, whether medical or surgical. In addition, with the emergence of newer, perhaps safer operations, there may be another tier level with intermediate step surgeries prior to trabeculectomy or tube shunts. I'd like to thank my panelists, Dr. Gross and Francis, for joining me in this interesting discussion. Thanks also to Medscape for producing this program. And finally, to you, the audience members, thank you for tuning in. Please complete the CME-CE post-test questions that follow as a measure for this continuing education activity, along with the program evaluation form. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Lowering Intraocular Pressure in Glaucoma, Medical Therapy versus Surgical Therapy. To participate in the CME activity, please go to cme.medscape.com/features/audio and select the title.